Now, there's a story behind this concerto. There's a connection not only between the Philadelphia Orchestra and the concerto, but between you and the concerto.
Well, insofar as my teacher was John DeLancey, and Mr. DeLancey really suggested the idea of an oboe concerto to Strauss in Germany following World War II while visiting him. And Strauss gave him a curt no for an answer. But then, not too long afterwards, he did begin work on an oboe concerto. And he mentioned in his notebook that it had been suggested by an American soldier that would be Mr. DeLancey. So I think that he deserves credit for this suggestion, because now it's come to be, I think, regarded as perhaps the greatest concerto ever written for the oboe, and it's played quite widely now. It was not played widely for a number of years for reasons that are kind of complicated.
John DeLancey didn't get a chance to play it right away.
No, it was played by an oboist, and it was premiered by an oboist in Switzerland. And then I believe Mr. DeLancey was offered the first performance of it in the United States. And he had recently joined the Philadelphia Orchestra. He was the assistant to Marcel Tabateau, the famous Tabateau. And I think he did not feel that it would be the right thing for him to do. That becomes very complicated. It's a difficult work for the oboe, and many oboists felt for years that it was not sympathetically written for the oboe. And in fact, it is not sympathetically written for the oboe, but it's a great piece of music. So like many pieces, people learn to accommodate it eventually, even though it's the reason it's not sympathetically written is that it's very taxing to play. It has very, very, very long lines. And so people were just had some trepidation about performing it for a number of years. It wasn't, strangely enough, it has a lot of Viennese music in it, but it was not, I believe, not performed in Vienna at all till perhaps the 70s or the 80s by oboists. So that's a strange fact.
And you'd think that Strauss had written opera, and he had written, I guess, the tone poems. You'd think, though, having written for the voice, he would be...
Well, he wrote the same way for the voice. It's extremely difficult. And it's a sort of an idealized that you never have to breathe. It's beautiful. So we find a way to do it to make it sound seamless.
Especially in the first movement, the lines seem so long and so lyrical and so beautiful, but the notes just seem to come one right after the other. It seems as if you're not taking a breath.
Uh-huh. Well, I am. And you have to be clever about it.
When we've spoken before and you've talked about different techniques that oboists used to be able to hold a line a very long time.
Yes, there's something called circular breathing, which I did utilize it to some extent in these performances. And it involves maintaining the air pressure that normally would be from your abdominal muscles. It involves maintaining it for a very short period of time by your cheeks and your tongue, because the oboe takes, in fact, very, very little air. And so if you can maintain the pressure and inhale through your nose, so you don't stop the sound and you're taking a breath through your nose. You can also exhale through your nose using the same technique. It used to be called the glass blowers technique, but it's called circular breathing. And people can do it amazingly on the oboe. It's relatively easy. People can now do it, I believe, on the flute and on the tuba, which is extraordinary. But it has a limited usage because, in fact, all music, really, for a wind instrument, you have to learn that the breathing is part of the music, and the music breathes. And my teacher, Mr. DeLancey, said the fact that we had to figure out our breathing was a blessing in disguise, because it forces us to phrase the music so that it does not just sort of an endless sequence of notes, but it's organized in a certain way.
Did you study this concerto with John DeLancey?
No, never. Oh, no. In fact, this seems odd to people, but I think it's wonderful. I studied with Mr. DeLancey, I studied etudes, And in the etudes, he discussed many, many principles of music and interpretation and so forth. And his philosophy was that this was, they gave you the knowledge and information to approach any piece of music and do it your own way with intelligence. And so I never played an orchestral excerpt for him. I tell my students this all the time. I played a few solo pieces on recitals at Curtis, but certainly never studied. And it's a beautiful concerto, and I like to play it, the Strauss, and I don't like to teach it.
Why don't you like to teach it?
Because I think that it has to be approached with a certain, you have to have some life experience before you can really play it well.
When you say that it wasn't played a lot when it was first composed, and now you regard it as one of the greatest oboe concertos, other than the fact that it's very difficult, what would you say are its distinguishing characteristics?
Well, it has a wonderful kind of combination of the romantic and the classical. So Strauss's favorite composer was Mozart. And so this has a certain clarity for Strauss that you would think of with Mozart. It's also concise, and not every work by Strauss is concise, particularly some of the later ones. And at the same time, it has the very, very rich, lush harmonies of Rosenkavalier, many of his earlier works. So it's, for him, he wrote it at the end of his life, and it's a kind of a fond, I think, remembrance of his youth. And so that's it. Really, every time I play it, I realize how good a piece it is and how great a piece it is. It gets better and better, actually. The older I get, I regard it with more and more respect.
Do you have any particular favorite parts of it?
Yes, the slow movement and the end of the slow movement, which is, I think, is a culmination of, it's very much like the most beautiful scenes in the Strauss operas, and in the great tone poems too. It's hard to describe. It's a sort of a warm and glowing kind of satisfaction that you get in the music. He often picks. He's very good at picking the right key for the right color and the right atmosphere. So that's there's a spot in the slow movement where actually the oboe, solo oboe, becomes engulfed by the orchestra, which normally a soloist might object to, but it's a kind of a surrender, really. And then there's a very slow, soft, final statement by the oboe, which is a very slow statement of a jolly theme that's stated in the first movement. And then it's stated very slowly and with a sort of wistfulness. And that's my favorite part of the piece. It's right before the cadenza.
Everything you hear on WRTI is made possible by members. Please join today.